Thank you very much. I have seen that my subject is stated to be exclusion in the State of Israel. With your permission, I will enlarge it, and although I will speak about State of Israel first, but I will also speak about exclusion, or as I prefer to say, segregation, or even apartheid, as I will try to show to that this word really applies, also in the territories and especially in the West Bank. The second remark that I will do before beginning my presentation is something about how I will try to combine various strands in my presentation. I will not only speak about justice. Of course, excluding people is injustice, and we have to strive for justice, but I will also speak about power. One reason that I will speak about power, because if we don't address our people striving after justice, people who won't bring justice, if they don't, let's say, let also dirty their hands with politics, and politics about power, then it quite often happens that the request of justice becomes barren and stays, so to say, in the air without realization. Of course, I don't mean betraying of principles, but sticking true to one's principles, also analyzing situation of power and understanding what betraying justice does not only to those who are suffering from it, but the society which inflicts it. After the short preface, let me begin with the presentation. The State of Israel is really, on many subjects, a mixture of democracy and denial of democracy. The subject, and in this case, the denial of democracy consists of segregation people who are defined legally as non-Jews. Let me go immediately to the actual case. The actual and the most important case is land. 92% of the land of State of Israel, I mean its borders as of June 67, belongs to the state. Of course, it will need another presentation, maybe another series of presentations, to describe how most of those 92% became the property of the State of Israel. But after all, certain areas of United States are federal land and the State of California, and this is also a subject, how they became the property of the United States. Let us omit, therefore, how they became to belong to the State of Israel and speak about their present status. Officially and legally, and also as is known in Israel to everybody, land belonging to the State of Israel cannot be used except for the benefit of Jews. I should say that it cannot be sold even to Jews, but to Jews it is rented for 49 hours, with 49 years, excuse me, with the automatic prolongation for another 49 years. Those long-term leases are being bought and sold and available for mortgage. They are really property. For all non-Jews, they are, and you will see in the course of presentation why I am using the term non-Jews, the land almost never is leased. If it is leased in very few cases, it is leased at the maximum for 11 months. In addition to leasing, there is total prohibition for non-Jews of using the land in many other ways, in building factories, opening business, and so on and so on. For example, if some of you went to Israel and if you visited Nazareth, Nazareth is built on private property, meaning that the owners of property there can do what they want. But above Nazareth, there is Upper Nazareth, which is a city for Jews only in terms of property. Palestinians who live in Upper Nazareth are sub-renters of the Jewish property owners, and they cannot ever buy property there by law. In the same way, if you will go to other places in Galilee, you will see that the Arab population in villages and other towns is surrounded by enormous areas of state land, sometimes leased to given to kibbutzim, sometimes not, in which it can never acquire, which cannot be ever used for any municipal or private use for the Arabs. I said Arabs because Arabs are actually the majority, the enormous majority of non-Jews living in Israel. But we will see immediately that the term of non-Jew has a very much wider significance, and I will therefore, after stating the facts, I will try to analyze this situation under three aspects. The first aspect is comparison to United States. As I said before, in United States you have federal land. You have in California land belonging to California, in Arizona land belonging to Arizona. You have, and I suppose, land belonging to the city of Sacramento, and so on and so on. Now again, if this land, if it is leased to people, it is leased to everybody without any religious or other distinctions. Let us say, I am told on good authority, that in Alaska almost all the land, 99.5% of the land, is federal land. Let us suppose that my fancy takes me to spend a year in Alaska. If somebody will tell me, let's say an official, that you will not be rented a piece of federal land for legal, which is rented to, let's say, to Christians, because I am Jewish, this will be discrimination and a clear case of antisemitism. Therefore, the same thing, by the way, happens in other countries. Mexico has land, has Mexican land, which at least it officially tries to give to all people without distinction, friends, whatever your country you inquire. Therefore, the first conclusion that I am drawing is that while I will be given equal rights, even let us say if I will visit United States for 1 year, in federal land, in other areas too, the great majority of American citizens, 97% of the American citizens who are non-Jewish, if they will arrive in Israel, they will not be able to rent or use in any way 92% of State of Israel simply because they are non-Jewish. This is the reason that I use the expression non-Jew and not Palestinians. And let me add to you, since I am speaking on behalf of Palestine Solidarity Committee, and since it's also my habit to criticize my friends and in fact anybody and everybody that I think deserves criticism, that I think that Palestinian Solidarity Committees are to be criticized because they are not drawing attention in this country that the Israeli discrimination is not only against Palestinians and not only against Arabs, it's against non-Jews. It's against the great majority of American citizens, whatever their origin and race, because in this way the nature of Israel discrimination could be much more easily shown. Let me tell you, let me give you an extreme case. There are many Christian supporters of the State of Israel in this country. For example, Reverend Falwell, Reverend Robertson, very many Christian reverends. But If, let us say, Reverend Falwell will take a fancy to leave you and to spend a year among us, he will, whatever his support of State of Israel, will not entitle him to benefit from the smallest area of land of the, belonging to the State of Israel. The prohibition to the division, the separation, the exclusion, whatever, apartheid, I would say, is absolute except one escape clause, which I will discuss in a few moments. Let me take another aspect of the situation, and also I will do it for special reasons. There are quite a number of Palestinians by now who serve in Israeli army. There are two groups, Druzes and Circassians, who have to serve in the Israeli army, but also very big numbers of Bedouins, Christians by now, and increasing number of Muslims serve in the Israeli army or in the Israeli police. To give you a case, among the Druzes who served the longer, some of them by now are not only officers but generals. The highest ranking Druze of Palestinian, therefore, officer in Israeli army is called Brigadier General Muhammad Ramel from village of Yarka, which is surrounded, by the way, by those state-owned lands. General Ramel used to be the military governor of Gaza Strip from 87-89, meaning during the Intifada. And he has on his wall of his guest room, there hangs a document, in which Israeli army thanks him for the service, for good service of that year. General Ramel cannot, of course, use any piece of the land, of state land. He tried to obtain for his village some of state land, and he was told that this is not possible. Now, why I am saying, bringing the case of General Ramel and other officers and soldiers of Israeli army, who are still discriminated and proceed about. I am doing it for two reasons. The first reason, because I am trying to think what my opponents and yours will say in response to any accusation of discrimination. And one of the usual responses is to say that Palestinians are disloyal or are suspect of disloyalty. As I learned on my tour, this is not unheard in this country too. And because of this, you know, we have to keep them separately, we cannot do this, we cannot do that. Now, of course, I think in my own person that this is nonsense, but it is not always easy to persuade an audience of Americans that this is nonsense. If I will bring a case of General Ramel, and as I advise you, if you take the case of General Ramel and other officers and so on, who spent 20, 30 years in Israeli army, you immediately make every rational person consider that they are discriminated not because of any disloyalty. A general who commanded Gaza Strip during Intifada cannot be suspected of any disloyalty, but simply because they are not born Jews. And I call, therefore, the Israeli discrimination system segregation a discrimination system which prohibits certain benefits and very important benefits in all areas of life, of which I am taking land as an important example, to all non-Jews. And therefore, I really advise you to speak about most discriminations in oppression in this term, to involve, therefore, the great majority of American people as potential sufferers of this discrimination. The second reason is comparison with South Africa under apartheid regime. South Africa, as probably you have, if you remember, you have seen on your TV and your press, had black force, which was used to support, to oppress blacks, to beat blacks, actually very cruelly, due in the interest of the apartheid regime. This force had officers, and if you will trust me, generals too. But the officers who beat who commanded the black troops who used to beat other blacks in Soweto still were not allowed to live in Johannesburg. The separation under apartheid was absolute, and a black could not cross it by performing any service to the regime. Therefore is my point about General Rommel and other officers. And this is why I introduce Reverend Falwell and so on. Whatever a non-Jew, whatever service a non-Jew will make to the State of Israel, he will officially and legally, as a non-Jew, remain discriminated in the state of discrimination. There is, however, one difference between the Israeli apartheid and the South African apartheid. That is the Israeli, and this is this my third aspect of the situation, which will bring me to Jewish, particularly Jewish considerations. If a non-Jew will convert to Judaism, then at the moment that he will legally convert, and according to the laws of Israel, become legally a Jew, he will enjoy all the benefits of the Jews, and therefore become eligible to use the 92% of the State of Israel. If, to pursue my former example, if Reverend Falwell or Reverend Robertson will take a fancy to convert to Judaism, in the moment of their conversion, they will become fully eligible for all the benefits which all the Jews receive towards the land of Israel. Now, this brings to me some very tragic consideration. In all the Christian states until 230 years ago, Jews were legally discriminated. And one of the forms of discrimination was to prohibit them to own agricultural land. Jews were allowed in Christian states, including in American colonies until the War of Independence and then American Constitution, to live only in the cities and not for to buy agricultural land. Let us say in the state of New York, Jews settled already in 17th century, but until the American Revolution, they could only live in New York and few other cities. They could not buy land either for private or for anyone. The same situation existed in all other Christian states. But in the moment that a Jew, let's say in New York or the country of my origin, Poland, converted to Christianity, let's say Calvinistic Christianity in New York and Catholic Christianity in Poland, at the moment of the conversion, he became eligible to own land and to all the privileges of the Christians, of the particular religion, the Christian denomination of his state. This is the change between the traditional state, pre-modern state, in which religion of the state determined privileges all people who profess the religion of the state were privileged or other were discriminated, and modern states, the first American colonies, then United States, and the second France, and then all other states, which introduced the concept of equality before the law. The first conclusion that I draw from it is therefore that Israel, in spite of its many democratic features, elections, parties, parliament, increasing freedom of discussion, increasing also for me, my situation is now better than it was 10 or 20 years ago, still is a pre-modern state in the sense that it has no equality before the law, and much more tragic, that Israel is trying to do to all non-Jews what the Jews have suffered from the others, from Christians mainly, before the modernity, before until, let us say, 220 or 230 years ago. We can say that we Jews, I am speaking now in, I am including myself in the majority, are trying to do to non-Jews what non-Jews did to us. This is, of course, a parody of that great Jewish saying by Hillel, don't do to others what is hateful to yourself. But you know very well that great ethical sayings are not always followed by peoples, individuals, or nations. And you also know very well that it is a tendency among persecuted, a wrong tendency, but tendency among persecuted groups to persecute others, to do to others what was done to it. I don't have to give you other examples. Let me go from this point about, I could give you many more examples about such discrimination based on rigid division between Jews and non-Jews and exclusion of the non-Jews, all non-Jews, from many benefits from the state and of course from equality in the state Israel itself. But in the but before going to West Bank, where this situation, when several aspects of the situation will become even clearer, I want to add one point about my stock example, General Rommel, who of course represents by what are by now many, many thousands of Palestinian soldiers serving in Israeli army, police, and other law enforcing agencies. Actually, it is not possible to assume that the young further generations, that the young people, let's say sons or grandsons of such people, will tolerate their discrimination and still continue in the present acceptance. You must expect, human nature being what it is, a protest. Therefore, from the point of power politics, from the point of making the state Israel as a state and the army as an army stronger, it would actually be better or more effectual if at least soldiers serving in the Israeli army would be given free, full equality. Or if not soldiers, let us say officers. But no such thing is being done, and we will see the application of this principle that ideology in case of Israel is stronger than power consideration. And in this, Israel is different from other empires or discriminatory or most discriminatory states. You will see it better illustrated in the West Bank. In the West Bank, by the time that Oslo Agreement was signed, about 70% of the land has been already confiscated and became the property of the State of Israel. The present percentage is according to the Orient House, the Palestinian office in Jerusalem, 73%. Other are going, are saying 71, 72. It is no big difference. I will use the round number 70%. Meaning that if we want to understand Palestinians, we have to understand, first of all, Palestinians of West Bank, visiting Palestinians, the entire Palestinian people, that if a Palestinian is just looking around him in West Bank, he sees more than two-thirds of his country closed for, to him for any use whatsoever. Of course, I am adding that it is closed for any use for whatsoever to all non-Jews, as I explained before. But this is not the crux, the most important point of the political problem. 70% in round numbers have been confiscated, but only 16%, 16 of the total, 16 of the entire West Bank, have been given to Jewish settlers, to Jewish settlements. By the way, before going further, let me remark that the expression used by entire American media, Israeli settlements, is incorrect. Those settlements, because they are on state lands, are only designated to Jews and to Jews only. 54%, 54 of the total area, are both property of the State of Israel and empty. They are denied to Palestinians, but they have not been given to ever to anyone else. Now, if the Israel, this is, here I am passing from facts and the interpretation to my own analysis. And my analysis says that if State of Israel would have been an ordinary empire or mini empire, and therefore interested in carrying out the Oslo Agreement, it would have been, it would have begun to distribute those 54% of empty lands of West Bank back to the Palestinian peasants from whom they were robbed in the last generation only in the first place. Because then the Palestinians, who their most important slogan is Sumut, attachment to the land, would have supported the peace process. And you can, I can tell you of authority of all my Palestinian friends, and it is also a reasonable thing to assume. But the fact is that those empty land were not distributed, and are not distributed till this very day. Not one dunum, not one piece of land of that land was given back to Palestinians. Now, a part of possibility of bringing Palestinian masses to the site of Israel and of the Oslo process, there is also another consideration which has to be to added to it. The media, including the American media, are full of the problem of removing the settlements. Now, I acknowledge that this is a real problem. There are 150,000 settlers in West Bank, excluding East Jerusalem. They have many supporters in Israel. Their settlers are armed to the teeth. They are threatening to open fire on the army. This is a serious political problem. Of course, I want them to remove whatever the threat, but I recognize at the same time that they cannot be removed by a snap of the fingers. That there will be preparation and, as we say in politics, troubles. But there are not the same difficulties in troubles in giving back empty land, which the settlers do not possess in any way. My conclusion is, therefore, that the key to understanding Israeli politics is understanding, is to grasp that it is ruled by ideological motives. In this respect, to keep the land belonging to the Jewish state, the Jewish land, Jewish. It is as simply as that. Of course, Israel is not on the only state in which ideology is important than everything else. But in understanding Israeli policies, the first and the most important principle is that ideology is the most important single factor determining policies, and profit, for example, or other considerations of power are only secondary. And if not something very unusual will not happen, let us say, as unsuccessful war, everything will be sacrificed as it being sacrificed now on the altar of keeping the ideology and ideological policies pure. Let me go to other areas of in the territories in which the same principle of apartheid, because it's clearly apartheid, can be observed. However, I will treat them more briefly. The first thing I will mention is water. Of course, West Bank is not Sacramento, more like Arizona, I would say, and the water is the most important single factor in agriculture. The rules about water are simple. Israel has carried in September 67 a census of all the use of water of all Palestinians, and from that time Palestinians cannot exceed the amount of water they have used in that time, almost 28 years ago, which means that their agricultural development is completely frozen. This limitation, of course, doesn't apply to the Jewish settlers. By now, the situation is more or less that 150,000 Jewish settlers are using almost twice as much water as the 1,200,000 or perhaps more Palestinians. In Gaza Strip, the situation is even worse. There, the number of the Jewish, I mean the entire Gaza Strip, not only the autonomous area, there the number of the Jewish settlers is barely 8,000. And the number of the Palestinians is 800,000, probably much more. And the Jewish settlers are using 28% of the water of the Gaza Strip, the 8,000. The 62% is used by 800,000. So again, extreme discrimination, which surely can be called apartheid. Let me take economy. And again, very briefly, the Jewish settlers, being Israeli citizens, can open any businesses and can enterprises as they want, and of course also are entitled to Israeli government grants. No Palestinian can open any business, any factory or anything without a permit from Israeli authorities, and this permit is usually withheld if the prospect is that what he will open will compete with Israeli industry. There are many examples of this kind, but I want, instead of giving you examples, I want to make a comparison. If you compare the economic development of West Bank during the Israeli rule, meaning from 67 to 95, on one hand to the British rule over all Palestine from 1980 or whatever to 1948, from the other side to development of Jordan, let's say from 67 to 95, you will see that West Bank and Gaza Strip were not developed at all, while the British, admittedly an empire, and have developed Palestine in many ways. For example, the British have built many government buildings, a port, an airport. No single government building or public building for any purpose has been built by Israeli regime serving the Arabs. Of course, many serving the Jewish settlers, but this is another thing. No road, no new road was built. You cannot point at a single piece of public development in the territory serving the population. This will become even more clear if I will address the latest development or the latest development in the field of apartheid, quite unknown in the United States. I think there was only one article in Washington Post sometime about 2 months ago, which is called the bypassing roads. What means bypassing roads, and I will, and for what they are intended. Let me first go to Gaza Strip, where the system is already operating because it was built before the initiation of Palestinian Authority, and then go to the West Bank, where it is in under construction. Perhaps you remember from the beginning of last week the name of the settlement Netzarim, in which there was an attack on settlers on Israeli patrols. Netzarim is a very small settlement of about 150 settlers, situated between south of Gaza City, with about 180,000, and north of complex of refugee camps, Shati and others, with another 800,000. People. What is the reason that this tiny place is being kept in such area? The answer is the road. From Israel, from the east, there is a road going to Netzarim and then continuing to the seashore. First of all, the road is apartheid road. Palestinians are literally prohibited to drive on it. The road is only for the settlers and for the army vehicles. By the way, tragically, but I mentioned something about ideology or racist ideology being more important than power reasons, this makes the attacks of Hamas very easy because every vehicle to be attacked is sure to be an Israeli vehicle. There will be no Palestinian cars on this road because Palestinians are prohibited to drive on it. The road is being patrolled by Israeli army, used of course by the settlers. It divides the Gaza Strip into two. It's under full Israeli sovereignty. There are other roads of the same description crisscrossing the Gaza Strip north to south, more or less north to south, and three roads are doing the same thing from the east to west. The most important road, perhaps, is on the border between Gaza Strip and Egypt, which on the whole border there is a military road belonging to Israel, quite legally, by the way, by terms of Cairo agreement, which means that Gaza Strip is under Israeli control still, only the control is exercised by means of roads, called bypassing roads because they never enter into any Palestinian town or refugee camp. They bypass it, but still go and cut the Palestinian area in what is called squares. Of course, it's not squares geometrically. Areas surrounded by roads. The same system is now being built in the West Bank. With only then the roads will also join settlement centers, but the same principle of apartheid roads is to be employed officially. Of course, there is reason for it. It is supposed to reduce tension. But the apartheid roads, all the same, with a system of roads crisscrossing West Bank in all direction. Obviously, the aim is to continue a Israeli control in a different guise and employing a new principle. The new principle which those roads embody is called control from the outside. Before describing in detail what it means, I want to make two remarks. First of all, that because of the mixture of apartheid and democracy in Israel, Israeli major policies have to be explained to the people beforehand, or at least to the more politically involved part of people, and are. Whatever I can say about Mr. Rabin or other Israeli prime ministers, I don't accuse them, and I didn't accuse them of being liars and cheat, at least not to us, maybe to foreigners, but this is a different question. And they always try to explain their policies beforehand, because otherwise they will not get elected again. The principles of the control of the outside were therefore already explained by Rabin before the elections of 92, and of course after this. And what I will tell you now is simply a paraphrase of the official explanation. The official explanation is that it is in terms of power, it is more effectual and also cheaper in terms of money and manpower to control a population by not entering into its centers. It is wasteful that the army will patrol the refugee camps so the children can stone it, it is wasteful and not important in terms of power that the army will enforce the rule that Palestinian flag will not be displayed, and so on and so on. But army can control the population by being always outside, either on the roads, patrolling all the time, or on the mountain tops around it, and being therefore always available but not visible inside. This is called the control from outside, and it is actually as far as power is concerned, I must admit, everybody admits it, that this form is much more effective than what Shamir and Sharon did, meaning putting little settlements in every place that they wanted, and in making the Israeli army enter also every place that they wanted. But this is also a better form of apartheid. The segregation is much greater, because actually the Israeli army stays outside and doesn't go inside. Therefore, the exclusion or the segregation is actually the greater. This is accompanied by another great change, again, official change in Israeli policies, the exclusion of Palestinian workers from territories from working inside Israel. You hear about it as motivated by the so-called terror and by the closure. This is actually a well thought out policy in which the small alleviations don't play a part, because at the same time, Israel is importing really enormous numbers of foreign workers from countries like Thailand, China, and Romania. And most of the work carried out by Palestinians from territories within Israel, let's say 4 years ago, is now carried out in agriculture by Thai workers, in construction by Romanians, and also by various other nationalities. I should add that those foreign workers are coming to Israel under conditions which are worse than Palestinians' workers. Only males are allowed to come. They can stay in Israel only for a year or at most two, and they can never return, meaning one shift is being taken out, another completely different is taken in, and then while they are staying, they are deprived both of their wages, most of their wages, and of their passports, and their wages are either sent in part home or most are held until they will finish their year or two of work. Indenture was luck. Chinese were imported to California 100 years ago, more or less the same conditions. Again, Israel is not a modern state, I am afraid. It keeps to the old customs in this way. But what I want to tell you, that this horrible system is of course meant to preserve the exclusion of non-Jews from Israel. Of course, as just as I say that Israeli Prime Minister doesn't lie to his people, the Israeli Prime Ministers are not complete fools. Maybe they have quite often an element of crassness in them, but at least they have advisors, they are not complete fools, and they know that Palestinians have to work in something, in the territories. And a plan for their employment actually has been drawn and is beginning to be implemented. The plan is called industrial parks. Industrial parks are complexes of factories which will be on Israeli territory but very close to borders of West Bank and Gaza Strip. The ownership of those factories will be Israeli. The money will come from United States government. And the purpose of those factories will be to produce for export to United States. I repeat, not for their own Palestinian society, not even for Israel, but export to United States. I will leave for your consideration who will profit from this, but I will make two points. First of all, this is innovation in terms of entire Arab world. Some Arab countries import oil to United States. No Arab country imports industrial products to United States. Secondly, if you will look around you in Central America, you will find some countries with a very similar system. Therefore, it is an Israeli imitation of America. And in Palestinian and Israeli terms, it actually represents a dehumanization, because it means that the bulk of Palestinian workers will not be involved in any work for their own society or even for neighboring Arab societies. I also leave for your imagination what it means for continuation of Palestinian culture and society, even in their present, admittedly, not so good state. Let me summarize. Those examples which I have given you, and many more can be added, show that you must analyze Israeli policies in terms of ideology. The most important aspect of the ideology is to preserve or to increase the Jewish character of the State of Israel. I am quoting official aim. And this means what it says. What I have described to you will make the Jewish character of Israel more pronounced than it was 5 years ago. The second thing, that ideological considerations are more important in terms of profit. For sure, any one of us can suggest other forms of exploitation of Palestinians which will be safer and more profitable. I am not speaking now of justice, I am speaking about ideology, more important than power. And in the last, I want to tell you two things which I consider very important. First, that you can know about Israeli policies from open sources. without any secrets, about any rumors, more or less everything is described. Only you have to skip diplomacy, you have to skip official declarations, hopes, illusions, and so on. You just have to look on what happens to the ground or what is predicted that it happened to the ground. And second, that you are, that people who support the just right of Palestinians, the justice of Palestinians, although their situation now in this country and everywhere is very weak, are potentially in strong position, because the weakness, there is one weakness in everything that I described to you. It cannot be, it will persist so long as it is not known outside Israel. First of all, of course, the longer that Palestinians are don't know about it, I mean now all Palestinians, not only those who will hear their effects, the policy can be carried out. But in addition, Israel is not an island, it depends on outside forces. In order to combat that policy and in order to combat the injustice and the apartheid character of State of Israel, I think that we have very much, very many means in our hands, and if we will use them, even in the present hard situation, we will be able to progress. But I will not hide from you that I am, what I am offering now to you as a proposal hides behind it something, a very harsh and maybe even cruel demand. Palestinians, after all, are being killed every day, or if every second day. There are many instances of humiliation, wounds, all kinds of things in which I am sure that Palestine Solidarity Group is engaged day and night. I didn't speak about all this. I didn't speak about this, and I suggested to you that you will, at least in part of your time, do what I am doing, meaning concentrate on those subjects. Because I am very sorry to say, and you must have observed it from your experience, that our opponents, or at least my opponents, have excuses, cruel and invalid excuses, but still excuses which American public will sometimes, we quite often accept, if Palestinian children are being killed. American public has no excuse for the sort of this discrimination that I try to describe to you. Therefore, I am asking from Palestinians and from their supporters that at least in their half of their activity, that they should rationally conquer their feelings, they justly outrage feelings, and concentrate not on the things that pain them most, justly pain them most, but on the things that are rationally more effective than any other way. This I tried to indicate to you in my presentation. And even if you don't accept my advice, please believe that it was, that not only is taken, I made it rationally, but it also comes from the heart. Thank you very much.